Good evening and welcome. I'm Kelly Richards, CEO of the All Access Group and the host of All Access Radio. As a sought-after consultant, super connector, trusted advisor, celebrity wrangler, and thought leader, I connect innovators and influencers from Silicon Valley to Hollywood to Madison Avenue. And as a trusted advisor, I transform the quality of people's lives. I'm also the author of the best-selling ebook, The Magic and Moxie of Apple, An Insider's View. Tonight's guest on the show is a returning guest and a longtime friend and colleague, Jim Griffin. Jim is managing director of One House, dedicated to the future of music and entertainment delivery, and he also works as a consultant, like I do, to absorb uncertainty about the digital delivery of art. In addition to serving as an agent for constructive change in media and technology, Jim is also an entrepreneur, author, speaker, magazine columnist, and is on the boards of several companies and associations. Previously, actually back when we first met many moons ago, Jim started and ran the tech department at Geffen Records, which were among the earliest to embrace digital technology some 20 years ago now. Jim's been hailed by CNN Money as one of the sharpest minds in digital music and an entertainment technology visionary by the LA Times. Both are certainly apropos. Welcome back to the show, Jim.
Thanks for having me.
Always great to get a few minutes with you.
I want to start,
Jim, by asking a question I've started to ask many of my guests recently, and that is, having a trusted advisor is so important. Would you share with our listeners some of the mentors you've had along the way and whether you've mentored others?
Well, sure. I mean, that's a two-way street, and the more of it, the better. And the more often you go up and down that street, the more you learn. I'd say I've had many of them. At the moment, I'm thinking about Jack Holtzman, who founded Elektra Records and
right.
who really was our industry's greatest technologist. And also crossed over to being a great executive as well, a general executive. Founded Nonesuch Records, founded Elektra Records, quite the fellow. Of course, is well known for his work with the Doors.
Of course.
Recording them.
Or signed them, didn't he? He signed them.
Yes. And it really had so much to do with their career. But I would just say that Jack in general was a great mentor to me in my career, made me realize that being a technologist didn't buttonhole you as an executive to just dealing with screwdrivers and plugs and cords, but could have an enormous effect on the direction of the business. Of course, Jack also was instrumental in Panavision and a number of other companies, so he's had his hand in technology and the direction of the industry for lots of years.
He's definitely been a bellwether.
Yeah, and I've gotten to work with him for a long time, even recently in my work at Warner when I was president of network licensing for 3 years recently, was able to work directly with Jack.
Fabulous. And mentoring others, equally important, Jim. And obviously, for the folks that don't know Jim's work in our little community, the digital music world, Jim and his colleague John Paris put together over 20 years ago now what we call the Pho List, named after a Vietnamese soup, and it's an online community of people in the music space. And every day, Jim is on posting observations and doing a fabulous job being the steward of this community. And, so you clearly mentor others even within our own community, and you have for many years.
I think it mentors me. I would say it helps me keep my finger on the pulse of the industry.
Yeah.
To be able to interact with so many people every day around these key issues is very, very important. I would say that the first lesson I learned at Geffen, and there were many, was that job one is to replace yourself. So
yep.
Mentoring others is a natural when your job is to replace yourself. And I would say for all of us, that's job one, whatever we do, whether you're in the entertainment industry or not. I mean, for most people, that takes place in having kids and having a family in some way. They're working to replace themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say in business as well, it's a very tough medicine to swallow, but you need to be replacing yourself from day one. Now, there's lots of reasons for this. when I was at Geffen, they would say, look, you can't go anywhere. You can't leave. You can't get promoted until you've replaced yourself. So you've got to replace yourself if you want to grow and you want to be a part of the business. I think it's very important leadership quality that you welcome footsteps and not feel threatened by them.
Yes, I agree.
But this is rare. We have so many people in the business who instead defend their position and do not look to be replaced. And I would say that's true more broadly, too. As an industry, we have to reinvent ourselves constantly, and yet we spend so much time playing defense to our own detriment.
Boy, well spoken, as usual. One of Jim's greatest gifts is he's a very eloquent, natural orator. And I always say that because I'm just so impressed by you're so facile with, you know, the right words that express exactly what we all want to, what we all need to hear.
Yeah, I don't think we have a choice. I really do think that when we come into this industry, it's essential that we figure out how to destroy the industry. And I say that partly because even if you want to defend it, you've got to know how it could be destroyed. Geffen used to say to me, look, every day I think about some 14-year-old kid who wants to be David Geffen, and if you can figure out how he's going to come at me, maybe I can survive. And that really is your job, is to be thinking about change, not only in your own position, but in the industry as a whole. What is the next format? How will people be listening to music?
Well, you know, you and I share the fact that we were both on the front lines of the biggest changes that were going to happen starting 20 years ago now or more. And, you know, we saw where the industry was headed. We saw what the opportunities and the threats were. But a lot of the entrenched players didn't want to hear it, thought that they could stuff a genie back in the bottle and didn't want to embrace the changes. And we both spent our careers being disruptors and catalysts of change to impact things in a more favorable fashion and to pull them along into the future.
Yeah, people don't like it, though, I'll tell you that. I mean,
oh, they don't.
I remember going to the first MP3.com convention,
yep,
a meeting Michael Robertson put together down in San Diego, and I recall thinking as I was preparing that we should be thinking about what's next and thinking about what's past MP3s, and I went and I said, streaming is your future. This was in, I think it was, 96.
Right.
Streaming is your future. That's where you're headed, and you need to embrace that. And people were really even throwing things. They were so angry to hear
this. And you recall, and I did the same thing, by the way. A reporter called me last week, the day Apple Music launched officially, and wanted my take, since I had birthed the music focus at Apple, and how far it had come, and was this the right direction? And I said, I told the iTunes team two nights before it launched in 2003, you're going in the wrong direction, it should be streaming. Now, you were ahead of me, as usual, by a few years, but we both saw that that's where it was headed. The Rhapsody guys had it right, you know? But, you know, when Napster came on the scene, and the option of consumers being at the center of the wheel as opposed to the labels, they just couldn't get their hands around it. They just couldn't embrace it, even when Napster offered them $1 billion, you recall. So to show how you could monetize an audience of 70 million people. But we digress. I don't want to live 15 years in the past. The past does impact the future, and that's why I'm bouncing back and forth a little bit on this conversation. The point is, Jim, you have always been, you've always had your eye on where things are headed, and you've always been very articulate about expressing that to everybody who would listen.
I'm lucky for that, and it's made for a good life, so I celebrate it.
I think so.
And very lucky to be where I am now and enjoying looking at the future still. You know, there's so much of it that still requires lots of attention, lots of working.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because, again, you're usually at the center of the wheel of what's coming next. And a lot of your work these days focuses on developing the key components of a sustainable economy for the digital delivery of art in many forms. In your opinion, what are those key components?
Well, I'll put it as simply as I can, and I think it's that we need to bring a fiduciary's care to the proceeds of art. I think we need to increasingly bring real standards to how we perceive value and how we reward value. No longer is this, a Renaissance fair business. This is a multi-billion dollar global business that owes a certain level of accountability to others in the value chain.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to require that we start to keep track of music that's used and who wrote it and who owns it and where that money should go and how you can get permission if you need permission to use it. I think another way to put it is that we need to make it faster, easier, and simpler to pay for music in hopes that when it is, more people will. And that goes for all media. When I say music, I mean art. I mean media generally.
Of course.
They're all really just now just piles of zeros and ones to a degree. And the times that we live in give us an ability to keep track of that. But we don't right now. All too often it's a pool of money with a relatively fair split, but without real metrics to dictate where that money should go.
And so what are the biggest challenges to making that happen, Jim, and why is it taking so long?
Well, there are those who benefit from the lack of a fiduciary's care, and they do not want to see that arrive, or at least not especially quickly. The key component is a publicly accessible database of the key identifiers that identify music. We do not have that today. The result of a lack of publicly accessible databases of those key identifiers and so forth is that all too much money falls by the wayside as it goes from those who use music to those who made the music.
Mm-hmm.
And that has to change. Those who use the music, by the way, they're happy to properly report their use of music, but they do not have access to the key globally unique identifiers that could be used. Here, I know it's going to sound esoteric, but I'm going to go there anyway. We have three very specific identifiers for music. We have the ISRC code, which is the International Standard Recording Code, and that identifies the sound recording, which is what you hear when you listen to music.
Right.
Behind the scenes, there's a songwriter, and they're identified through what's called the ISWC, the International Standard Works Code. And the locations of those people that are identified, they're contained in a separate database called an ISNI. It's a relatively new code, ISNI, and it's an international standard for names and identifiers.
Mm-hmm.
When you put these three together, you can positively identify the songwriter or a sound recording or the people involved with them. But here we have a unique exception, which is that there are no publicly accessible databases of any of these identifiers. And so those who use music, who seek permission to use it, or who want to report their use of that music, they can't access these codes. And so, in a way, it's as if we made wire transfers or wrote checks purely by our name without any routing number or coding number on our credit card or our checks or our financial instruments.
And recipients aren't receiving the funds.
Right. So it would never happen that we did business that way with money. But with music and with media, that is the case. And before you feel too bad for music, realize that photographs, they don't even have these globally unique identifiers.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
We start from scratch when we deal with photographs or graphics. But the key components of art, they need to be identified in order to be properly rewarded or in order that someone can seek permission to use those works. So,
well, I have a feeling, Jim, if we ever get around to having such global registries of claims, it will be in large part due to your efforts. I mean, I understand you also work with the UN on these issues and other global, maybe WIPO?
I do. They have a powerful motive, and it's not theoretical. They run the patent registry.
That's right.
The global patent registry that not only records and enumerates patents on a global basis, but it also allows an inventor to apply once instead of in 60 to 90 different countries. So
what is their stance as an organization and their role in helping to make this passion a reality?
They want to build these databases. They do. It's important to them. Their goal is to further copyright. That's their only existence. That's what they're around for. And they do this with the trademark registry and the patent registry now. And so you might ask yourself, well, if it's good enough for patents and it's good enough for trademarks, why aren't we doing that in music or with pictures or with text? And that's precisely the point. We need to start doing that. These are fundamental components. In some ways, they threaten those who don't want granularity in payments, those who prefer a pool of money with a divvy, because perhaps they have mastered how to get that money. And when they get that money, they don't have to share it with anyone else because, as they say, it's a pool of unattributed income, so we feel no obligation to pay royalties on it. This starts you down a ugly road of why artists don't get paid in music or in other things like photography or sometimes with video, et cetera. What we're bringing now, I think, is a fiduciary's care, and that is slowly evolving, and I think it's inevitable. I don't think there's a strong argument against it. Certainly the transition will take time, but it's essential that we get on with that.
Yep, I follow that logic. And how does your work with startups such as Orange Genius figure into this?
Orange Genius is an interesting startup out of Manhattan that's focused on addressing the problem with graphics and pictures. That's where Orange Genius takes its stand, and it will likely morph into other mediums as well, but there's a paucity of work in this area of dealing with graphics and with photographs and so forth, and so Orange Genius gets on to getting that done. It's run by a fine woman named Grace Cho, C-H-O, who was an executive at Nielsen and at General Electric before she took this problem on. I like advising her and helping her. She's got a strong head and very, very organized and is going to make the world better for photographers and graphic artists.
With your help behind the scenes, certainly.
I enjoy that. I'm an agent of change. I like to enable other people, and so I get great joy out of it.
And so shifting specifically back to music, I understand you're also currently doing some work with startups like Sweethold and Castleton Music. Can you tell us a bit more about those projects?
Sure, Sweethold is fascinating. You know, I think we could all sympathize with the hell that is hold music. know, that when you are on the telephone and you are placed on hold, that you, you know, hear terrible music, if you hear music at all, of course.
Right.
You know, I think it's, I've determined that it's largely the licensing situation that prevents businesses from properly licensing music for their hold circuit. And so have, together with some colleagues, created a company called Sweethold that's goal is to make hold truly sweet and to deliver data to the owners of the phone line as well about who hung up and who was on hold the longest, but primarily to take this problem from hell to heaven.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, Polestar could use that. With all due affection, I produce the Polestar Awards every year, as you know, part of the conference, the annual conference.
Sure.
And when you call Polestar, I'm going to say, Jim, for the last 7-8 years, you get one song. It's Lee Nash from Sixpence None the Richer, There She Goes Again. And I was so bored with this the 100th time I heard it, although I love the song, that it made me think, oh, I'm going to invite Lee Nash to be a presenter at this year's Polestar Awards.
You know, it's funny.
And she did. She came this year. But that was like the best thing that came out of that. Otherwise, you feel like Groundhog Day, you know.
Yeah, I'm especially fascinated with a area of music use, which is purely performance. It's in restaurants or retail or on hold circuits. And what fascinates me is that traditionally, in its analog form, these uses of music and others like them pay nothing for the use of the sound recording.
Right.
But do pay the songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, gee, there ought to be a business that takes the opposite approach and seeks to pay for the use of the sound recording and the song and does this properly. And I took it on as a licensing challenge with some colleagues, and we quickly got it licensed. It took some arcane knowledge. Again, most take the position that you need only pay for the song.
Naturally, yeah.
You know, and yet, clearly the song is not the only thing being used. The sound recording is being used. And SoundExchange offers an excellent licensing system that gets half of the money directly to the performers without recoup. It's 50-50, one of the best deals in the business.
Yes.
So we license through SoundExchange and put together a hold music system, and hopefully you'll be hearing it and others will be hearing it soon.
That's
terrific. Interesting because you really do get your ear to the ground when you're out buying music to be used in a music service.
Yeah, and so many millions of people. I mean, imagine the potential to a songwriter about their song being heard by millions of people directly and indirectly in terms of the profitability of that.
Yes, no, it's important. And what's critical is that music, as it makes its transition from product to service, you know, we go from selling you the music to selling the crowd that it draws.
Right.
It's a very different business. And so we have to grow those service businesses in order to replace the lost income from the decline of product sales.
That's right.
So I'm especially
interested. But in so doing, you also get more data. It's data analytics. You get more data on user behavior that's valuable.
Sure. I find this transition important, essential, and a place to focus my efforts.
Yeah, clearly. And again, you're just doing a bang-up job with it. Now, I understand that maybe in June of last year, you testified before the House Judiciary Committee on music licensing issues. Could you share what the basis of your testimony was for that?
Yeah, I think we pretty well covered that because my advocacy for registries is largely what took me there. I will say this, that largely what I wanted to suggest to them and did in my testimony is that they start to think about public-private partnerships and how they can be less like the taxi commissioner and more like Uber.
Uh-huh.
Now, and I think this applies to lots of different jobs that government and others undertake in today's age. What I mean by this is that when you have a very complex problem, you need to avoid the temptation to rule things with your own hand and to start thinking about incentivizing markets in that thing. And so I think that if the Copyright Office thought more like ICANN does about registering domain names,
mm-hmm.
and incentivizing others like GoDaddy and Namecheap and an endless number of registers for domains, that we would see the same thing happen for registering IP, for registering music and movies and books and the like, is that if we incentivized others to go out and advertise and to do those registrations, we'd have a lot more information about them.
Yes.
There wouldn't be the registry problem that there is. And I'll tell you, I think if you found 100 musicians at random and you asked them how to register their music, you'd find maybe 10 that had any inkling of how to do it. But if you asked them how to register a domain, I think 90 of the 100 musicians would know exactly how to register a domain.
Astounding. Astounding.
And the reason that's true is that we advertise the registration of domains. We have a free market in it. We have the government not seeking to rule it with its own hand, but instead incentivizing others to seek profit by engaging in registration. Today, registering a song costs $55 and might take 13 months. This really should be done in milliseconds and
yes.
has a marginal cost of under a dollar.
Correct.
So if you think about it, we really tax registration today quite heavily, both in terms of time and money resources. And the market offers an opportunity to cut through that bureaucracy and deliver a market-oriented solution. So that's what I testified before the House Judiciary Committee about, is this opportunity to look differently at things like registry services and to incentivize the work's performance as opposed to spending government funds on it. And I'll tell you, some of the things that go on at the Copyright Office just defy belief. I mean, the notion that they pay people to listen to your music to determine whether they think it's sufficiently original enough to give it a copyright is bizarre to me.
Yeah.
I say slap a number on it and move on. I mean, who are they to hire people to substitute their judgment on creativity for someone else? We just need to put a number on it. We don't need to be listening to all these songs or guarding them in warehouses for hundreds of years. So,
right, right, right. It just seems like in the 21st century with apps and all the online services that we have created, we should be able to cut through that with like a knife through butter in terms of just
exactly.
It's online, it's 5 minutes, it's $5 or less.
Yeah, it's hidebound today. And so
yeah.
I can't blame people for not registering.
The disincentivization for them to even bother to go through it.
You might blow $1,000 on it right away and
see no real
benefit from it. And I find that appalling. So,
well,
but I'll say this, there's great people at the Copyright Office. I think the world of our Register of Copyrights, Maria Plante. I think she's fantastic. I think her crew is great. I think they want to do great work. I think we just have to enable them.
Well, one final comment on this whole thing, which, of course, is the thrust of our talk today because it's so much the core of what your work is, Jim. But you wrote a follow-up article after that hearing for Billboard. And on the experience,
yeah.
I think you said something like, congressional hearings are to public policy what speed dating is to romance.
It's
is there
true.
Anything else you want to elaborate on about that, or have
well,
we covered
it's just
it?
All these clocks that interfere with no reason whatsoever. I mean, if you give each representative, say, 5 minutes to ask questions, and if each representative uses 4 minutes and 45 seconds to ask their question, you get but 15 seconds for an answer. It's not reasonable, really, that you should only get 5 minutes to ask a question. I mean, sure, the hearing has to end at some point, but it really is unfortunate because as I sat there, testified, answered questions myself, and saw my colleagues answering questions, I wanted to hear more. I wanted to hear more questions, and I wanted to hear more answers.
and when you speak, it's hard for you to be so terse and succinct, and we want to hear the embellishments and the things you've got to share that expound on that thinking. So that's kind of goofy.
I try to get them down to memes, but it's not easy. I just wanted people to know that behind the scenes, well, what you see on the evening news is maybe 15 to 30 seconds of clips, if that. But what happens in that room is sort of oddly ruled by the clock.
I think everybody in the industry should have some time in D.C. to experience that whole inner workings and see for themselves how draconian so much of it is, even though there are probably some, as you say, some very well-intentioned people who are trying to change it.
Look, this is the problem, is that you really cannot deal with this area without the government. And I laugh because I have a friend who says that even the absence of copyright would require the government, because you'd have to have the police there to hold people back from protecting their stuff with guns. You know, I think the point is that you need an orderly process
yep.
for dealing with copyright.
Yes.
You know,
and
you can
there
only
are too
imagine
many constituents
the
with their own agendas to have some kind of a fair outcome, probably without government intervention.
Well, there are just so many possible outcomes that are not good that long ago we decided we needed the government to step in this area, and I'm sure that's largely right. And while we do need reform today, I think everybody agrees on that. No matter what their point of view, everybody thinks we need reform, that we wrote copyright for a different age, that a digital age is quite different. But I think there are few who question the need for copyright or who seriously question the need for copyright.
Yeah.
Properly done, it's essential. Improperly done, it's unfortunate. So, yes, I do hope we can make some differences, and testifying is one of those opportunities to go forth and let people know what you're thinking.
Yeah, as is publishing, et cetera. And, in fact, you've said, Jim, that one of the best things you've done in your music career is to have attended the Leadership Music Program in Nashville, class of 2013. Given the breadth and depth of your career, that's a pretty big statement. So could you tell our listeners what was so impactful about that program and who you would recommend it to?
Well, I recommend it to anyone in the music industry who has done something important or risen to a certain level where they feel that to get to the level after that, they should sit down and reflect with their colleagues about the industry. Essentially, you relearn the business. Every month, you take on a different part of the business, touring, publishing, making a sound recording in the studio, public policy, et cetera. Each of these are given a month, and you travel around on a tour bus in Nashville, Tennessee, around the town every day of class, and that's where you get your education. And you do it together with colleagues from record labels, publishing companies, and so forth. And I didn't think I would get in. I was delighted I did, and when I went there, it changed my life. It was transformative. It made me think of these issues in very different ways. So I recommend to anyone, and even if you're not in the music business, there's a model here, a leadership seminar that goes on for a year where you meet once a month in an important city that relates to your industry, and you work together with your colleagues to understand that. Now, I'll tell you, some of the important rules are that you have to give up your cell phone, you have to stop with the devices and so forth, and be focused and interactive with those around you. You have to give up this time, and you have to devote it to your education and to the program. So it's a mid-career, towards the end of your career thing, where you hope to learn and give more back and be organized with others. I really can't recommend it highly enough.
Well, for our listeners,
Nashville too. I mean, you have Nashville is Music City. I hadn't spent enough time there. I'd been in L.A., I'd been in New York, I'd had executive positions in the music industry in both of those places.
Sure,
but I never worked in Nashville.
Yeah, it has been overlooked by people on the coasts for years, and it's changed so much in the past 10, 15 years. It's definitely a stronghold for music throughout the country. And in fact, two shout outs here. One is, for listeners who want to learn more about this, do go to leadershipmusic.org. That's the site where you'll learn more about what Jim's describing with this program. And secondly, Jim and I share a friend and colleague in Nashville named Tom Truitt, T-R-U-I-T-T. And Tom is a Music Row exec in Nashville, and he is doing regular gatherings for people that come through Nashville. You should know about this, called Who Knew, as in K-N-E-W. And it's a speaker series that features music industry pros who share their wisdom and insights that they may or may not be widely known, but it's very much worthwhile to check out. Have you been to one of those, participated one, Jim? I'm guessing.
I was the first speaker at the first event.
Of course, naturally.
So in fact, Tom and I sat down and we drew the whole plan out together for Who Knew.
Well, there you go. I didn't even know that. So there you go.
Yeah, he'd had Tom. And he called me and said, you know, I'm trying to figure out what to do with this LinkedIn music group I've created. And we got to talking about live events, and I had suggested that the live event is an area where we're still in control, that you still control the quantity and destiny of seats.
Yes.
And you can charge what you want for them, and that's because there are, in fact, security guards. And he loved this idea. And he asked me to be the first speaker at the first one, and I agreed to that. And I've been helping him put these together along the way. Trust me, I don't do anywhere near the amount of work he does. He's really principally responsible for getting this done. But we sit down and we look for a fascinating list of speakers. I could squeak under that wire because I was the first one at the first event.
There we go. Now, Jim, I swear I didn't even know that. I'm glad you have connected those dots to have added that into the conversation here. And, of course, we share another great, a longtime alum, Nashville piece of the puzzle here, which is Michael Dorf with City Winery.
Sure.
You know, he's done a fabulous job, as you know, of opening a House of Blues-like chain. He continues to do it around the country in various cities where he's got this beautiful venue to have music performed and enjoy wonderful wine, one of which is in Nashville, just opened a year ago. So,
yeah, Nashville is drawing lots of people, and
exactly.
That is fantastic. In fact, I'll tell you now that on July 22nd is the next Who Knew.
Okay.
That's not long from now. I guess that's, 16 days from now?
Do you have a website for that? Do you know what the website is to give our listeners for that one, Jim?
You know, I don't recall off the top of my head, but you could write Tom at musicrowsearch.com.
That's right.
A Facebook page for the event.
Yes.
So that would be a place that you could look as well.
So, by the way,
they're always full. I've never been.
Yeah.
In fact, there has not been an event that has not sold out every seat to standing room only.
I believe it. And a lot of these people are peers of yours and mine, esteemed colleagues for decades who are really driving change in the industry. So for anybody who wants to check this out, Google Who Knew Nashville, and I'm sure you'll find it, or go to the Facebook page.
Yeah, it's a great deal too, by the way. I mean, I seem to recall it was $10 and you get two free drinks. So in Nashville, that's
not a bad deal if you're going to be in Nashville. Check it out. I have two last questions, mindful of your time, Jim. And I'm so grateful that
you're away.
One of them is, it's kind of personal, but, you know, I know that you moved out to Virginia. You're in a small town about 45 minutes from the White House in Virginia, however
right.
many years ago now. And I'd love for you to share with us, you know, what life is like for you to be able to live and work with that being your command post. Obviously, your wife, Stacy, is also in the business, and you've got a brilliant, precocious child named Hazen, who we've been watching grow up over these many years.
Well, you know, it's funny out here. It really is. I mean, we've been here a decade. I love my family and so forth. But when we came here, we did not know that there was no really good digital access. And by that, I mean there is no cable company. There is no internet company. The local phone company will not give you data service to your house.
Oh, boy.
The result is that you use satellite access. And that is highly latent. So you learn how to respect digits and how they get to your house.
Oh, my goodness. I think if I were ever to move, the first question would be, can I get cable or internet access?
Yes.
But you've made it work regardless.
Yeah, no, I've made it work, and I'm celebrating because it now looks like now 10 years into it, they're going to bring a digital circuit to my house.
Do you know, this puts me in mind in the Wayback Machine, going back 20 years of when I was working with Todd Rundgren, and I moved out to Kauai, as you recall, where he was living
sure.
for a while when I left Apple.
Love Kauai.
And we had to petition to GTE Hawaiian Tel to bring, early cable to the island. We got it before any, DSL, it was DSL, before any of the other islands had it.
Of course, the good news is that Hawaii, due to its nature, it was one of the first wired places. You know, you don't have such an enormous expanse of land. And, of course, you can do really good wireless work and wired work in Hawaii, so they've
yeah.
been leaders in connectivity over a long period of time. Here in Virginia, it's different. And I'll tell you, it may surprise you to learn that in a somewhat neighboring county, not too far away, they prohibit all wireless communications.
Oh, my goodness.
They have many excuses for why they do it, but principally it's for our national security, because there are listening stations there that listen to satellites from others, and so they don't want any interference. So literally, cell phones are banned, all wireless communications are banned in that community.
And so this is interesting. So you moved out there from LA because you wanted to be more centrally located between, say, D.C., New York, L.A., and London, huh?
Yeah,
or Europe.
And I wanted a little community because
yeah.
I didn't want to raise our son in Southern California.
I got you.
I didn't want to look 10 years, 20 years later and see that we raised a mall rat who demanded
a
Mercedes.
He certainly has been raised in paradise, near as I can tell.
Yeah.
And every time I see him, which is not very often, every couple years, he's just growing into the wisest, most wonderful kid. Offspring of two great parents, of course, but you guys seem to be doing a great job, and he's living the life out there. What a great place to grow up.
Yeah, we're very lucky that we have ponds and streams and fields and a little less than 300 people here in this community, and it's a lovely
yeah.
place to be, so I feel fortunate.
Good deal, and it doesn't seem to have impacted your work too much. You know, you're not really you're off the grid to a certain extent, but you're 45 minutes from D.C.,
yeah, and Dulles is about a half hour away, so I can get on a plane and go anywhere.
That's terrific.
After all, that is what it was about. When we came here, I was going to Finland once a month, and it was taking roughly 100 hours round trip to go from Los Angeles to Finland and back.
No
and
kidding.
That is, for most people, almost their month of work. So just for one trip,
that was
much easier from here.
That was when you were working for Nokia, of course.
Yeah,
have to give attribution.
Of course.
But
go to
before
Pittsburgh.
We wind up our chat, and I suspect you've answered this, Jim, but I'll just ask it anyway because I do like to ask all my guests this legacy question. It's one of the most important questions is what comes next for you and a project or collaboration you haven't yet started but you dream about creating as part of your legacy. I believe you've already answered it with regard to this registry, but is there something else I've overlooked?
Well, I have a passion for the registry. It's planting a seed in whose shade I may never sit, but those are my favorite projects. I remember when I came to Washington, D.C. for the very first time, I saw the Washington National Cathedral, And someone remarked to me that the people who started the cathedral, their grandchildren finished the cathedral. And I thought to myself, gee, those who plant trees and whose shade they may never sit are probably those who we should herald and exalt the most.
Well, there's a good bet you're one of them, as much as I hope it's otherwise.
Well, you know, I'm very, very lucky to get to do what I love every day.
Well, Jim, you know, thank you on behalf of myself and all of our colleagues in the digital music space. You're such a lightning rod for all of us, and I couldn't be more grateful and thankful to call you a friend and a very cherished colleague. So thanks again for being here with us on the show tonight. I always enjoy our conversations.
I'm lucky. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. Give my best to Stacy as well. And
okay.
Want to thank our show producer, Jessica Mastor, for her wonderful job each week as well. We will hear you all again next week on the next edition of All Access Radio. Good night, everybody.